Much of what we take for granted about life in the world today is made possible by inventions. Somebody had to come up with the idea of getting around with machines rather than horses. Somebody had to figure out how to stop diseases before we even caught them. Somebody had to see a way to feed billions of people on the same land that once fed millions. It all comes back to science, which has done some truly wonderful things and some truly awful ones. We'll hear a bit of each today from a new book called Pandora's Lab, Seven Stories of Science Gone Wrong. Paul Offit is the author. He's a pediatrician with an expertise in vaccines. He's a professor of vaccinology and pediatrics at the medical school at the University of Pennsylvania and the director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. Dr. Offit is the co-inventor of a rotavirus vaccine and the author of several books and dozens of articles. The books include Bad Faith, for which he joined us in March of 2015. Dr. Offit, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you work with the benefits of science every day. How did you end up getting to a focus on bad science or science poorly applied anyway?
I think what happened is my son and I visited an exhibition at the Franklin Institute, which is a huge science institute here in Philadelphia, and the exhibition was 101 inventions that changed the world. Two of those inventions were gunpowder and nuclear energy, and it seemed to me that, you know, you could argue that those didn't change the world for the better, and so that led to a discussion between me and my son. And then for the next 5 years, when I would speak at meetings, I would ask people what they thought inventions were, list some inventions that they think might have changed the world for the worse, and this ended up being the seven finalists.
Wow. So you actually made a very, very democratic process out of getting nominations. How long a list of nominations did you start with to get to the seven finalists?
About 50.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And how hard was it to pick the seven finalists?
Not too hard. I mean, it usually was on the basis of the following, which is that it had to have an enormous amount of praise when it first came out, preferably winning a Nobel Prize, and then did an enormous amount of harm.
Okay, so they're not absolutes in the sense that they were just horrible in the first place. I mean, people thought that there were going to be good things when they were first brought up.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's start with opium, revered for centuries as God's own medicine. What is in that plant?
Right. Well, the main active ingredient, one of the most powerful and certainly the most powerful natural analgesic or pain reliever, is morphine. And at the time when we first discovered opium, which was the Sumerians back, 6,000 years ago, the thinking was this is going to be great. I mean, it's a pain reliever. It's a euphoric. Hippocrates used it to treat nausea. But even then, 400 BC, there was this little known Greek named Diagoras of Milos who said, I'm worried that some of my fellow Greeks are going to get addicted to this or are getting addicted to this. And it's a warning we pretty much ignored for the last 2,500 years. Which is that we cannot effectively separate pain relief from addiction, whether it's opium or whether it's morphine or whether it's a synthetic form of morphine, which is heroin, or whether it's a synthetic form of another product in opium called thebaine, which we call oxycodone. We just never seem to learn this lesson.
And the history of addiction, as you point out, is vast in both time and space. I mean, basically 2,500 years is what you're saying?
Right.
All across the world?
Yes. I think we it's just failed to learn this lesson. I think it's an example of medical hubris. I think we continue to think we're going to get better at it. Okay, morphine is addictive. Why don't we synthetically modify it so it crosses the blood-brain barrier much more efficiently, which is what heroin was. And same with oxycodone. I think we thought, okay, we've taken another product from opium, which is thebaine, and we've modified that. This is going to be the answer. We have to stop. We have to get over our opiophobia, our fear of opioids, and this is going to be fine. And now, pain became the fifth vital sign. It's very hard to walk into a doctor's office and not be asked within the first three questions whether you're in any pain, even if you're sitting there comfortably. And I think we just have gotten to the point where we think that people can't spend one moment in any sort of pain, and we're willing to write prescriptions for major painkillers. And I lay this at the feet mainly at doctors, because we're the ones that are writing the prescriptions.
And that we finally cut way down on the prescriptions, haven't we? Or are we still in the process of doing that? I mean, if the White House is talking about trying to deal with opioid addiction, it's still a major problem in the country, right?
Absolutely. I think in the last year, things have gotten much better. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have come up with guidelines. The American Medical Association recently said that we should eliminate pain as the fifth vital sign in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We really have to warn people, and I work at a children's hospital, we have to warn minors or their parents of the addictive nature of these products. We have to get consent. So I think things are starting to clearly swing in the other direction.
Well, you've said it very briefly there in just that last paragraph, but the CDC just issued its own guidelines within the last year?
Right.
Why did it take the CDC so long to do that?
I don't know. I think we were just slow to react to this, but I think we finally have it. Certainly this has been a problem, since the year 2000 in terms of, you know, by around then was when you started to see deaths in young people, you know, caused by opioid abuse, started to exceed those caused by motor vehicle accidents. You know, it's a real turning.
All right, we've talked about the long history. I do want to go back in time a little bit, though, and talk about when we had the first laws to ban opium use and what prompted them in America.
Right. So what prompted them was that, you know, we were sort of starting to enslave our nation. I think what was interesting was when heroin first came into the country, which is in 1895, it was actually sold over the counter. And it was, you know, Bayer, which is a German company, made that product at the same time that they made aspirin. Aspirin was available by prescription only, but heroin was available over the counter for 30 years until we realized, obviously, it was addictive. And then we created, you know, in 1924, an act that basically made heroin sale illegal, and so it went underground. This is sort of one of the things that surprised me in this. When it went underground in the early 1920s, it was taken up by the mob, who really, you know, distributed. In the early 1900s in this country, the mob were primarily Jewish gangsters, like, you know, Meyer Lansky and Arnold Rothstein and Legs Diamond and Dutch Schultz. Those guys were all Jewish mobsters. And the term that they used for addict was schmecker. It's a slang Yiddish term. And the term that they used for heroin was schmeck, which then got anglicized to smack.
Oh, is that where the term came from?
Yes.
So the way this history reads, drug companies say, well, this new version of opium works better. Doctors resist but finally succumb, and then bunches of people get addicted. You could just change the year in the drug, it sounds like.
That's the way it's worked, time and again. I think the interesting thing was when we there was the hypodermic needle was invented, which was in the sort of mid 1850s, actually by a doctor in Edinburgh, this Alexander Woods. He thought, okay, this is going to make sense. We'll because if we give it intravenously, people won't develop an appetite for the drug, and that didn't work either.
Oh, well, an appetite in the sense of like going over the palate, the tongue, that sort of thing.
Right.
Wow. We're talking about opium as one of the inventions that came out of Pandora's lab, seven stories of science gone wrong, things that people thought were wonderful when they came out and then obviously had different feelings about down the road. Paul Offit, MD, is the author of the book and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Dr. Offit and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join the conversation. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Offit, a medical doctor, pediatrician with expertise in vaccines working in Philadelphia. He's written a number of books and a pile of articles over the years. We talked to him last in 2015 about his book, Bad Faith. He's back with another book called Pandora's Lab, Seven Stories of Science Gone Wrong, inventions that looked wonderful when they first emerged from the laboratory and in some cases got Nobel Prizes, and then we had a change of heart or a change of thought about what was being wrought upon the human race. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, I want to finish up with talking about opium and opioids. I mean, I'm still stuck on the fact that even after all the experiences with taking one part or the other of the opium plant and realizing, whoops, this is addictive too, we thought that synthetic opioids could be any better.
Beats me. I think it's just largely a matter of hubris. I think, you know, we have believed that, you know, that chemistry will find a way, and we just keep not finding. And the reason is that the opioid-like products bind to the mu receptor. We make our own sort of opioid-like products. We make our own endorphins, which is just endogenous morphine-like chemicals that help relieve pain. You can actually make your own endorphins, and that they all bind to the mu receptor. And the mu receptor is what allows us to experience pain relief. It's what allows us to experience euphoria, and it's also what causes us to be addicted. And until we can figure out how to find a different receptor to do these things, we're always going to be paying this price.
You know, I was reading, and it was not a medical source this morning, that some of the pleasure we get from using our little electronic devices and looking at screens, those also kind of hit the receptors that opioids hit?
Yeah, it's interesting. Exercise and eating spicy foods can all be associated with releasing endorphins.
Wow, okay. All kinds of things to learn about opioids and how they hit the brain. Let's move on to Chapter 2 and margarine. This starts with a story from your native Baltimore, Balmer, if you'll forgive me. What are burgers cookies?
Yeah, Burgers cookies, grew up with them. I mean, I didn't know at the time that I was sort of, you know, increasing my risk of heart disease dramatically because they tasted so damn good. But I think that this was an interesting lesson. I mean, in the 1970s, 60s and 70s, there was a sort of person, a diet guru, if you will, named Ansel Keys, who said fat is bad for you. We should eat less fat. We should, you know, restrict our diets to have fewer than 30% of our calories coming from fat. And so he created this sort of heart healthy alternative. The thinking was that butter, because it's made from animal fat, will be bad for you, whereas margarine, which is made from partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, will be good for you, and thus driving us into the waiting arms of trans fats, which, you know, the Harvard School of Public Health estimated probably caused about 250,000 heart-related deaths a year.
A year?
A year.
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to say that was total. So what is it we're doing to the fats then? I mean, because, you know, the general sense you get from any one of a number of people who speak about nutrition is you're better off eating parts of plants than parts of animals. So what could we possibly do to these parts of plants that makes them so bad for our hearts?
Well, first of all, fats aren't evil. I mean, fats are sort of critical to, you know, to cell membranes and to a number of cellular processes. So we need fats. The question is, you know, there is a certain kind of fat that can be bad. And in this case, I think what happened at that time was, first of all, fats were evil. And then as we sort of learned more, we said, no, saturated fats are evil and unsaturated fats are good. And remember, trans fats are actually an unsaturated fat. And so that's what in part drove us to unsaturated fats. I think we learned as we went. Then as we got better at understanding, there are different kinds of cholesterol. There's high-density lipoprotein and low-density lipoprotein and very low-density lipoprotein cholesterol. And when we got better at understanding all that, then we saw that the trans fats, which were initially in you know, products like Crisco and margarine, were although they made for wonderful cooking products, they were sort of tasteless, so they didn't sort of mask the taste of anything. They it's the so-called fat hardening process, and it's very convenient from a cooking standpoint. Unfortunately, it was very bad for us from a health standpoint.
I had not heard about the VLDLs before that you just mentioned, the very low-density lipoproteins.
Right. So there's LDL, which is kind of a fluffier, bigger molecule, and there's the VDL, which is a very low-density lipoprotein, which is a sort of a more dense thing. So, yes, it's the VDL, VLDLs, which are the worst.
So early in your career, and I'm not suggesting you have been practicing medicine for a very long time, but were doctors still telling people to eat margarine instead of butter?
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you very much. But no, I trained in medical school in the 1970s. So yes, absolutely. And then there you had Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, telling you that you should use margarine as she's spreading it on her breakfast toast. So there were a lot of people that were pushing you to margarine. It was Ansel Keys coined the term heart healthy alternative, and that's what margarine was.
So it's interesting history here. Where did margarine come from in the first place?
Oh, I think it came from Napoleon. From way back when in the 1700s as oleomargarine. Was what it was originally called.
Okay. I remember my father used to refer to it as oleo, so he had been around it long enough to hear that name still. A lot of politics in this fight, it sounds like. We certainly watched what happened when the likes of New York City started saying, you know, you need to get the trans fats out of the restaurants. And people were saying what I think Mr. Berger was saying in Baltimore, that we can't make this stuff without trans fat.
Right, we are much better at it, though. I mean, the if you look on the labels, you can very easily see whether or not there's trans fats. And for the most part, trans fats are all products, including margarine. For all the questions about, you know, what is the safest, best, healthiest diet, the one thing that has never been controversial is whether trans fats are bad for you. Study after study has made that very clear, that trans fats do things like increase very low-density lipoprotein, decrease high-density lipoprotein, which is a good kind of, I'm sorry, high-density lipoprotein cholesterol, which is a good kind of cholesterol. And so I think we've learned this lesson, but it took decades.
So pound for pound, ounce for ounce, are you better off using butter than margarine?
Well, now it doesn't matter. I mean, now margarine is made so that it doesn't contain trans fats. So
okay.
I think now it doesn't matter. Then it did.
All right. Let's take a call here. We have Karen in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Offit, who is the author of Pandora's Lab, 7 Stories of Science Gone Wrong.
Is this Karen?
Yeah, this is you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm in the medical field, and about 15 years ago, they had this big push on pain management, and that we had classes and stuff, and their big justification was that how much opiates were used in Great Britain to control pain, and they didn't get the addicts. Was this true, or is it debunked?
Right. So, Karen, it's a great question. I think there were two things that liberalized the use of opioids and opiates in this country. Opiates are things that are directly derived from opium. So morphine is an opiate. And then opioids are synthetic modifications of morphine. So like heroin and oxycodone are opioids. But what happened was, and it started in England, actually, associated with the hospice movement. So you're right. It was a woman named Cicely Saunders who said that, "I don't think people who are in the terminal stages of their illness should spend their last days crying out in pain, and I think I should be able to give them morphine, or I should be able to give them heroin." And that also influenced this country in the mid-1980s, where we passed the Compassionate Relief Act, which said that we, too, were allowed to use heroin in patients who were terminally ill in hospice situations. Then what happened was, in the 1990s, there was a pain specialist in New York City, actually, named Russell Portnoy, who said, "We shouldn't be so scared of opioids. We have to get over our opiophobia, you know, our fear of opioids." And he pointed to a paper, which was actually very thin, saying that, look, here's 38 people. They used opioids. You know, only two became addicted. They'd been addicted before. I think this whole addiction thing is wrong. And as it turns out, that was dead wrong. And I think as we've learned the lesson by making pain the fifth vital sign and giving way more opioids than we need, that we've created addicts.
Explore that a little bit for us. When you say pain as the fifth vital sign, so it's something that we're always asking about, and are you suggesting we should not?
Yes, I'm suggesting that I agree with the American Medical Association when they, within the past year, say we should eliminate pain as the fifth vital sign and stop and take a step back, which is to say that if people are experiencing pain, then first of all, try other things like acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like ibuprofen, or physical, you know, therapy and occupational therapy. And if you do prescribe an opioid, don't prescribe it for more than 3 days. Make sure that it absolutely works. And if it's for chronic pain, don't prescribe it for more than 7 days, and don't give refills. So I think they're really trying to crack down on this sort of over prescription. You know, you have places like in West Virginia, counties in West Virginia where the pharmaceutical company that makes these products is selling the kind of quantities there that would mean that every person living there would have to be taking it round the clock. I mean, it's evident that we're overusing these products, and the pharmaceutical companies that have been making these are certainly not, they have dirty hands in this too.
We talked to an author last year who came from not far away from where you're talking about. He grew up in Ohio, in a town where there's a heavy opioid addiction and heroin now, obviously, because people are switching to heroin because it's cheaper in a lot of cases. His observation was that we seem to expect we need to lead a friction-free life in America.
I think that's exactly right. It's like no one can experience a moment of pain. But, you know, everything comes with a price. I think it's sort of the heart of this book, is that anything that has a good effect also is likely to have, to some extent, a bad effect. And you just want to make sure that the benefits outweigh the risks, and you want to make sure that you know the risks. And I think with opioids, we've been very slow to learn this lesson. But I think we have, in the past year, learned it.
Annette and Eugene adds to that with an email. She says, "The problem isn't the substances, it's the humans." We're talking to Paul Offit, who's a medical doctor practicing in Philadelphia and a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, expert in vaccines. His book is called Pandora's Lab, 7 Stories of Science Gone Wrong. We've already talked about opium and margarine. You can join the conversation on the exchange as we keep moving ahead. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So now we turn to Fritz Haber, and wow, what a setup, a man who saved many lives and sowed the seeds of our destruction at the same time.
Yeah, he's an amazing story, actually. First of all, it's, you know, at the time that he was doing his work, it was clear that we were on the verge of starvation, in the sense of being able to feed what was a growing number of people in this world, especially in, you know, heavily populated urban areas. And so we had to find a better, you know, it's not hard to get carbon because, the, you know, plants are plentiful. It's not hard to get oxygen because we can get it from the air. It's not hard to get hydrogen because we can get that from the air also. But from the water we drink. But you know, nitrogen's different. Nitrogen only comes from soil, and we were, you know, we were basically at risk of sort of depleting nitrogen stores. And so we had to find a way to take nitrogen really from the air, because, you know, 79% of the air is nitrogen. Unfortunately, it's two nitrogen atoms that are bound by a triple bond, which was the strongest bond in nature. He figured out how to disrupt it, how to bring it from the air into a form that's usable in the soil, and that made it so that we can feed feed more than 7 billion people on this earth. Because it has stood, if we used every arable piece of land in this world, and we're great about rotating crops and using manure as fertilizer, we would be able to feed 4 billion people in this world. That's it. But the 7 billion is because of him. So I would say half of the nitrogen in our bodies is because of Fritz Haber. The problem is that as you bring nitrogen from the air and put it into the ground, and then it, you know, leaches out of the ground and into waterways, then you start to do things like have algae overgrowth, and you start to do things like kill fish and kill mollusks and kill those that feed on fish and mollusks, and that's what's happening. I think if anything, if you had to pick the one process that we've done that probably began the clock ticking on our own destruction, it's that. It's pulling nitrogen out of the air and putting it into the ground.
We can return nitrogen to the soil through natural means, though, right? Is it just much less quick and efficient than using ammonia?
Yes. Well, first of all, lightning actually is able to sort of split the nitrogen and bring it into the ground. And there are certain clovers and plants that actually have enzymes that are able to pull nitrogen out of the air and put it into the ground, but it's much less efficient than his process, and it would have never been enough.
So we get ammonia for the fertilizer. What else? What are some of the other byproducts of the process that Fritz Haber came up with?
Yeah, no, that's it. It's ammonia, and that form of nitrogen is what's really doing harm. The other thing interesting about Haber is he was the father of chemical warfare, which, I mean, he was the first really to use chlorine gas during World War One, the first one to use phosgene gas, the first one to use nitrogen mustard. And so when he won the Nobel Prize for figuring out how to bring nitrogen into the air and put it into the soil, there were a lot of people that boycotted that event because of what he had done in World War One with chemical warfare.
That was the part that really astounded me. He actually got his Nobel Prize after World War One.
Yes, 1919.
Wow. So a few scientists stayed away from that particular Nobel dinner?
Yeah, and I think the other thing that was remarkable is he was a brilliant scientist, there's no doubt about it. And he was the one really who was responsible for sort of this delousing program that they had there, you know, delousing barracks and delousing granaries, and he was the inventor of Zyklon, you know, which is a hydrogen cyanide gas, which became Zyklon A, which became Zyklon B, which became the method of choice for killing, you know, roughly 6 million Jews during Hitler's reign. And well, he never saw that. He was expelled from Germany in 1934 because he was Jewish. And I think most people don't know that, you know, that the inventor of Zyklon actually was Jewish. I mean, he obviously never predicted that use. And when he left Germany, he said, "I feel like I've put fire in the hands of small children."
So he did have some regrets then about some of the things he'd invented?
Enormous regrets. Mm-hmm. Not so much for the pulling nitrogen out of the air. I think he had regret with chemical warfare ultimately, and he certainly had regret for what was the creation of Zyklon.
Wow, and I think about the other uses for ammonia too. I mean, even the ammonia fertilizer can be used for explosive weapons, as it was in Oklahoma City.
Exactly right. That's what Timothy McVeigh did. Exactly right.
Wow. Okay, we're talking about some of the inventions in history that started out looking really good and ended up very bad. Pandora's Lab, Seven Stories of Science Gone Wrong is the book. Paul Offit, MD, is our guest on The Exchange, its author. Eugenics, here's something that I just never knew who was at the beginning of this in the USA. So tell us a bit about who Madison Grant was.
Right. That was actually the most frightening story in all of this. Madison Grant was a New York City conservationist and lawyer. He wrote what I would argue was the most popular scientific treatise ever written. It was called The Passing of the Great Race. It sold 1.6 million copies. It made a case it sort of took eugenics one step further. So you had Mendel, who figured out that genes were responsible for certain physical properties in plants, like, you know, the color of the plant or the size of the plant. Then you had a guy named Francis Galton who said, okay, let's take this one step further. I think that these genes also determine other characteristics like loyalty or bravery or whether you're going to, you know, turn to prostitution. I think this all is determined by genes, and I think that is passed from family to family. So he creates eugenics, which just literally means well-born, and what I'm going to do, says Francis Galton, is I'm going to try and encourage, you know, marriage among the best of us and discourage marriage among the worst of us so we can breed a better population of people. What Madison Grant did is he took the next step. He said it's not just passed from family to family, it's passed just it's true among races. There are superior and inferior races, and so the superior races was his race, what he called the Nordic race, which comes from, you know, from England or from Germany or from Western Europe. And then there were the inferior races, which came from Italy or Poland, you know, Italians, Jews, and we have to stop their entry into this country. We have to make America great again by basically refusing entry. And so there were a series of four immigration laws that were passed in the 1920s that basically slowed this to a trickle, the immigration. Then what happened was in 1925, that book, The Passing of the Great Race, was translated into German, where it was read by a young German corporal imprisoned in Landsberg prison in Bavaria, who wrote a book to Madison Grant saying, "This book is my Bible." He then took whole sections of that book, Grant's book, and put it in his book, which was called Mein Kampf. And when he came to power, when Hitler came to power in the early 30s, he made the book Passing of the Great Race required reading for young German citizens, and race purity met its hideous, illogical end.
It is just amazing to think about the idea of eugenics originating more or less here, didn't it?
Yes. Well, it's actually the origins was Francis Galton in England, but okay, took it to... there were 20,000 sterilizations in the United States based on that notion that, you know, that we were going to create a better race of people because we could breed cows and we could breed horses. Why not breed better people, too?
Well, that's the whole idea behind eugenics, and not a pretty one. We'll talk more about it when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Paul Offit, who's the author of Pandora's Lab, Seven Stories of Science Gone Wrong. He actually went through a fairly democratic process to bring in suggestions for what to include in the book and came up with seven finalists, and a lot of them nominated, if not actually awarded, Nobel Prizes, despite the ways in which they were used for ill later on. We'll continue the discussion with Paul Offit. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking once again with Paul Offit. We talked to him a couple of years ago about his book, Bad Faith, about how people try to heal their children through religion rather than through medicine. He's professor of vaccinology and pediatrics at the medical school at the University of Pennsylvania, director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. His latest book is called Pandora's Lab, Seven Stories of Science Gone Wrong, which pretty much sums up what we're talking about here. Ideas that looked really great when they first came out, even got awards, in some cases Nobel Prizes, and ended up then being used for ill or just not working up to the original promise we thought they might have held. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're in the midst of talking about eugenics, the idea that you can breed a better population, which includes sterilizing people you consider unworthy. Madison Grant, who was one of the major American proponents of this, you mentioned him as a conservationist. What kinds of things was he famous for in his conservation work?
Well, probably most famously was saving the redwood trees in California. That was his project. In fact, and he, you know, he was really responsible for a lot of the park system that we have. At the time, it was only Yellowstone National Park, which was called the National Park. He was responsible for that, and he, you know, a lot of, you know, the Bronx Zoo, the Brooklyn Zoo, the all that was him. It's interesting as the tremendous impact he had on all those conservation efforts. You would have trouble finding his name because of his role in saving, quote-unquote, the Nordic population. The only place his name exists, actually, is at the base of the Founders Tree in Redwood National Park.
So he's been scrubbed from a lot of the things he did that were good.
Yes.
In a sense, he didn't have his genetic material survive.
Right.
Wow. So quite a club, though, of eugenics believers, well beyond Madison Grant. Who were some of the notables in that club?
Well, I mean, it was taught in virtually all the major universities, and the head of Stanford University, you know, was a big proponent of eugenics, as was, you know, Theodore Roosevelt. We believed that we could make a better race of people, and we took it the next step. I mean, it wasn't just a matter of encouraging good marriages. I mean, we felt that people who were drunks or prostitutes or whatever should be sort of isolated treated in single-sex institutions so that they wouldn't breed. And then we encouraged sterilization. And it went to the Supreme Court, you know, the case of famous case of Buck v. Bell, which I would argue is among the top of our most embarrassing Supreme Court decisions, where, you know, basically it's a girl who was, you know, she was bright. I mean, she could do crossword puzzles.
Carrie Buck. You know, yeah, we talked to Adam Cohen about his book Imbeciles last year.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's a great book. And you know, the famous line is, you know, from Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. when he basically supported this thing that we could sterilize people who we felt were lesser people. You know, three generations of imbeciles is enough.
That was the most shocking thing to me about that. Is it really Oliver Wendell Holmes was the one who wrote that?
Right.
That was shocking. So obviously, if major figures of the time got caught up and the American public took to it, I mean, so I'm trying to figure out where all the points connect here. I mean, you talked about immigration restrictions were put in place at the time. I mean, directly because of belief in creating stronger races in America?
Yes. Well, you know, you hear echoes of this today. I mean, it's frightening, actually.
When Steve King talks
about building walls. Mm-hmm. That's what they talked about then. We're going to build the walls to keep the browns and the yellows and the blacks out. I mean, that was the rhetoric that was used. And the same sort of rhetoric of, you know, we're going to sort of make America great again, it's actually the same. It's the same phrasing. It's a little scary. And immigration slowed to a trickle. That's what happened as a consequence of that. It was it's sort of a nativist, sort of isolationist, xenophobic time.
So the rise of the Ku Klux Klan in the 20s is definitely part of that picture, it sounds like.
Very much so, yes.
All right. So this is the same kind of thing that Steve King was talking about recently, the representative from Iowa, when he talks about you can't rebuild your society with somebody else's babies.
Yeah, not his best line. Right.
All right, let's move from eugenics off to another tasty subject, lobotomies. I mean, oh my God, what actually happens in this procedure?
Right, so this was a Nobel Prize winner. The Portuguese neurologist named Egas Moniz won the Nobel Prize in 1949 for work he had done in the 1930s. He called it leucotomy. When it crossed the Atlantic Ocean, it was called lobotomy. And there were probably 40,000 lobotomies that were done in the world, 20,000 in this country, 7,000 by one person, who invented the so-called ice pick lobotomy, where you would just take essentially what was physically what looked exactly like an ice pick, and you would put it in the upper inner aspect of the eye, and you would drive it about 3 inches into the brain and pull it out, and then you would do the same thing on the other side, often done without sterilization, occasionally done without anesthesia. And it would take about 6 minutes to do it. He did 7,000 lobotomies himself, and he was a Philadelphian who trained at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine, so you can blame us.
So I'm guessing he doesn't have a plaque.
No, actually, there's a former, what was a sort of state insane asylum that actually has him has a plaque about him, but it's really been turned into a spooky house.
So, okay. So is the process of lobotomy done anywhere in the world anymore?
No.
Okay. Well, does the idea, though, of shocking mentally ill people back into mental health still hold on in some form?
Well, I think the thinking then was that they were going to try and separate the frontal lobe from the rest of the brain. The frontal lobe is sort of what determines, if you will, sort of personality or affect. And if we could do that, then we could sort of make people better. Probably the most famous person that was lobotomized was Rosemary Kennedy, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Robert F. Kennedy and John F. Kennedy's sister, Joe Kennedy's daughter, because he wanted a miracle. And he wanted to believe that this would make his daughter better. And Walter Freeman, who was the guy who did these lobotomies, convinced them that she would be better. And it rendered her largely vegetative. It was just a tragedy.
What kind of condition was she in before the lobotomy?
She was mildly mentally debilitated, mildly. She could write, she could read, she could tell stories, she could go to parties, she could travel. She was generally completely functional. It's just that she wasn't a Kennedy. And I think that Joe Kennedy felt that in some way she was an embarrassment to the family. Sometimes when she would get angry, she would sort of flap her arms, you know, and gesture wildly. And this was embarrassing to him. And I think he felt that at some level it may hurt him or his other children politically. And so he wanted the quick fix, but he didn't get it.
She ended up spending most of her life in an institution, didn't she?
That's right. And no one visited her. It's interesting. Her mother stopped visiting her. The father stopped visiting her for the last 20 years of his life. The only person that visited her actually was John F. Kennedy during one of his campaign stops.
Wow. Let's take a call here. We have a call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Paul Offit about his book, Pandora's Lab.
Hello. I have a question about immunizations, which we didn't immunize our children back in the 70s and 80s just because we felt that it was an experiment. And I'm wondering, Paul, what your thoughts are about immunization in relation to the autoimmune diseases that are, you know, seem to be increasing.
Okay, not the topic of the book, but certainly in Paul's wheelhouse as the director of the Vaccine Education Center at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia. And Paul, your thoughts?
Yeah, and so an autoimmune reaction, you know, like lupus, for example, or rheumatoid arthritis, it happens when your body reacts against itself. And this has always been a question with vaccines. Could vaccines not only induce an immune response to the pathogen that you're trying to get it to, but to yourself? And I think the answer to that question has been no. You know, the only example I think where a vaccine caused autoimmunity, it wasn't in this country, but there was a swine flu vaccine that was given in 2009 in Scandinavia and in Europe that was called Pandemrix. It was squalene adjuvant. It was a squalene adjuvant vaccine which we didn't use in this country, and it caused narcolepsy, which is to say a disorder of wakefulness. And there was a reason for that, which is that one of the proteins in that vaccine, the so-called influenza nucleoprotein, actually cross-reacted with the protein that sits on the surface of the cell that makes the protein called hypocretin, which is necessary for wakefulness. So I think that was an example of so-called molecular mimicry between the vaccine and the host that could induce that. But if you look at all the other vaccines, they don't have molecular mimicry, which is to say that the vaccine itself doesn't mimic a host protein or one of your own body's protein, so it's not going to induce autoimmunity, and that's why it never has. But hopefully you're immunizing your grandchildren, because it's not an experiment anymore. I mean, vaccines clearly work and save lives.
So what do you make of the current situation where you've got people left and right questioning vaccines in America?
Yeah, so vaccines certainly are not a political issue. Both sides get this wrong. I think it's a frightening time. I think we're at an age where it's what psychologists call the anti-enlightenment movement, where evidence doesn't seem to matter. You simply declare your own truth, and at some level, I think science is losing its place as a position of truth, something for which we'll pay a price.
Which moves us on to Chapter 6 in your book, Pandora's Lab, which is the Mosquito Liberation Front. And we talk about Rachel Carson and DDT in here. She was already famous before Silent Spring. I didn't realize.
Yeah, this was the hardest chapter for me to write. She's a hero to me. She was really the first to stand up and say, I think we need to look at what we're doing to our environment. I think humans are affecting our environment, which is absolutely true. Climate change is not a hypothesis, it's fact, and she was really the first to do that. And the problem for me in this was that she was famous. You know, she wrote The Edge of the Sea or The Sea Around Us. Those books were like top 10 best-selling books at a time when the New York Times didn't separate out fiction from nonfiction. I mean, she was competing with books by Herman Wilk or books by J.D. Salinger. She was right up there with. She was a great writer. She was a great science writer. But in Silent Spring, where she warned about the use of the pesticide DDT, she overstated it the case. She claimed that it caused leukemia. She claimed that it caused uterine cancer. She claimed that it caused children to suddenly die. That wasn't true. And I think what happened was she scared us so much about DDT that we stopped using it not only in agriculture, which was reasonable, but we stopped using it in public health. And when we did that, I think there were millions of children who suffered needlessly from malaria that didn't have to.
All right, so that's a really interesting point here, which, as you mentioned, this is the hardest chapter to write. So are you suggesting that DDT should still be used in some amount?
Well, it's back. I mean, in 2006, the World Health Organization reinstated the use of DDT because they realized that was an important part of their public health program.
So do all pesticides, you think, have some use? Is there any that you would ban outright as DDT was once banned?
Well, yeah. I mean, there are better. There are certainly pesticides that are more or less dangerous. I think the one thing that she did, that Rachel Carson did, that was prescient, was she said, I think we should consider biological controls, which now are being done. I mean, things like introducing sterile mosquitoes or introducing sort of bacteria that are larvicides for mosquitoes. I think she predicted that in the early 1960s. I really wish she just hadn't gone as far as she did with claiming DDT as a cause of human harm, because she was wrong about that. And you know, because of her, we created what was called the Pesticide Commission, which became the EPA, or Environmental Protection Agency, one of which first act was to really ban DDT for agricultural use. And it really, DDT use dried up around the world, and children suffered then.
Do you think that she would have approved of all the changes made? Because she didn't live to see the EPA. She died not very long after Silent Spring, right?
That's right. No, and if you look in the book, she doesn't really say, she says, I'm not saying don't use it. And she says that, and her supporters will point to that. But she was such a good and effective writer. And when you say things like, you know, that something is causing leukemia, you can't on the other hand then say, but I'm not saying don't use it. I mean, people won't use it if they think it causes leukemia.
Okay. So what was your figure again on how many people you think might have been saved from malaria if DDT had been used?
I think tens of millions.
Tens of millions. Okay. Let's move on to Chapter 7, Nobel Prize disease. And, oh, man, here you're going to beat up on Oregon State University's beloved Linus Pauling.
Right, who was, a brilliant man, right? He won two Nobel Prizes. It's not like, you know, they're giving away these things in Cracker Jack boxes. It's not easy to win two Nobel Prizes, you know, one for peace, but the other, and more importantly, for figuring out this sort of structure of proteins. But in his mid-60s, he came to believe that megavitamins, which is to say vitamins taken vastly in excess of the recommended daily allowance, could initially cure the cold or prevent colds, and then he extended that to treating cancer and treating a variety of other illnesses. And that just wasn't true. And you know, when you take large quantities of vitamins, which you're not meant to take, I mean, your stomach is only so big for a reason. So, for example, if you pop a 1,000-milligram vitamin C tablet, you would have to eat 8 cantaloupes to get that much, or eat 14 oranges, and our stomach is only so big for a reason. So I would argue it's an unnatural thing to do. And now there are many studies showing that actually if you take these large quantities of megavitamins, you actually increase your risk of certain cancers and increase your risk of heart disease. I don't think that's actually a scientific controversy anymore. And I think if this were a regulated industry, meaning if the FDA actually did regulate it, I think some of these vitamin preparations would have black box warnings on them.
I know people who recommend taking vitamin C intravenously, because that when you get past what the body would normally do to it.
I know. Mehmet Oz has been pushing that. It's hard to watch.
So there are cautionary phrases you mentioned in the epilogue in the book, and they're listed in boldface in the wrap-ups in each of the chapters. It seems like these cautionary phrases should be part of science teaching. Are they? And are they forgotten, or are they just not put out there?
I think most scientists are pretty cautious. I think we're very quick to sort of buy into the magic. I mean, to believe the single study. Recently, there was a study, for example, claiming that bacterial sepsis could be treated much more effectively by also giving vitamin C. And you know, it's one study. And I think I'm going to predict that it's not going to be reproduced. But we tend to fall for this single study. So when Andrew Wakefield published the notion that the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism, that was an extraordinary claim. And I think we should follow Carl Sagan's line that extraordinary claims should be backed up by extraordinary evidence and certainly be reproduced. And we should wait, just wait a beat before we sort of jump into things so we can make sure that we're right.
All right. Well, as always, we get quite an intellectual workout when we talk to you, Paul. And the book is called Pandora's Lab, 7 Stories of Science Gone Wrong. Paul Offit, MD, its author, our guest. Thanks again, Paul. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. All fun right. Talking to you.